You have to start living life, Ryan. It's time to go home. Hi, I'm Chaz Fisher.
And I'm Stuart Willis.
Welcome to Draft Zero, a podcast where two Aussie filmmakers try to work out what makes great screenplays work. And this is episode two.
So last episode, we looked at the work of the gurus and how they applied to two Oscar-nominated screenplays, Philomena and Dallas Buyers Club.
So we found areas of those two scripts where the guru formulas, as we're referring to them, Snyder, Haig, and Vogler, fit and some didn't fit. But I just wanted to say, because I don't think we covered it in our last episode, that we were stretching these formulas to fit at several points. And I think as soon as you are doing that, as soon as you're stretching them in any way, they're losing their value as a rigid tool. And I think it was something that we came to is that these structures may have a use and a purpose in writing, but they shouldn't be adhered to as if they are gospel.
I think what's was funny, I was listening to a podcast with Shane Black about Iron Man 3, yet another Jeff Goldsmith Q&A. And basically, he was presented with an analysis of Iron Man 3 in the context of the hero's journey. And Shane was like, I should just play the quote.
Thing is, none of the things you just said, although wonderfully articulate and intricate and perhaps insightful, actually went through my head at any given point.
But then he expanded the point, which I think is very true, is that you get a sense of the structure of films by watching them and by reading screenplays. And that's how kind of you an absorb an understanding of how they work. So in some ways, the analysis, it becomes a chicken and egg thing, that the hero's journey has become so common in the way that we talk about filmmaking, that at what extent is our scripts then getting made with it consciously and then that becoming feeding back subconsciously.
So should we just mention why we're repeating this exercise for episode two?
With the two films we looked at last week, critically acclaimed films, biopics, very character-driven. And we went, well, it's probably, to be fair to these gurus, they're talking about archetypal stories, which are more likely to be used in large tentpole movies. So Chaz and I looked through the list of the top US domestic box office last year, 2013, and picked the first two movies that were non-franchise, non-sequels. And they were two animated films. They were Frozen and Gravity.
Is that a little bit controversial to call Gravity an animated film?
I was watching all the previews last night. I mean, I think it's controversial, but so much of it is, you know, it's such an interesting blend of animation and live action.
Well, that's a really good point that I was actually wanting to ask you about before we jumped into our analysis exercise, which is you've got a lot of experience. You've worked in post-production on a number of big animated movies. And I wanted to ask about Frozen in the script, and what you're suggesting is this could apply to Gravity as well, is how much do you feel that the script that we're reading and analyzing today, how much do you feel that that's the script that they had ready and then said, now we're going to animate this script?
That distinction creates a false dichotomy. I mean, the fact that you even call it post-production in the context of animation is a little bit misleading.
Yeah,
it's because production. It's production. But it's not even, it's a different kind of production. Animation is a very particular way of making films. I think it's extremely iterative, and I think that's awesome. And I think there's a reason that animated films, on the whole, tend to be better story-wise than live-action films, because they go through a lot more of a rigid process to get into production. And you actually also get to see the film really early in the process. You know, I've watched story reels that are basically just boards of the whole film. I've cried in the screenings of storyboarded films, which shows how much of the story can be worked out without any of the other stuff. You know, I still think you can learn so much from what she's done on the page. I had a different experience with you reading the script because I read it after seeing the movie. So those moments, those little montage bits were shorthand to me, and I could reference the emotional or the visual of the film that I saw. So it's interesting that you had a different experience, which is why I think it's probably worth jumping off from here to talk about Gravity rather than Frozen, because Gravity is a film that is very driven by action and visuals, and there were people that criticized the script before it went into production, Script Shadow, as being dry, a dry script, yet obviously the film itself is an incredibly riveting experience and is certainly...
And what I had, what you had with Frozen is what I experienced with Gravity, because I'd heard so much bad stuff about the Gravity script that I went into it thinking, oh, this is going to be a chore. But I'd seen the film before I read it. And for me, the film was one of the greatest cinematic experiences of my life to date, watching it. And while I was reading it, I was feeling those emotions that I felt in the cinema. So I actually felt that the script was very well realized and an excellent read. But I was prejudiced because I'd been in that film and had been on that roller coaster.
I mean, you can't help bringing those emotions as kind of flashbacks to the experience. And that's why, as much as possible in this podcast, we have been reading the scripts first. But unfortunately, in both these cases, I did see the films first. And I think there is some really clever writing. Before we get into the guru stuff, one of my favorite little sections that I highlighted just in terms of trying to recreate the cinematic experience on the page is around page 24. The PDF that's on the... that's out as part of the awards thing does not have page numbers in the corner. So I'm going off the page number of the PDF, the document reader. So on page, about page 24, it's when Ryan, the astronaut, is floating away and she's taking quick short breaths. And they've literally written in big print, R-O, R-O, like every breath they're writing as a separate line. And it really, to me, on the page, really gives you that sense of how much he's struggling to breathe. And there's other little examples throughout of how they've tried to write the experience for the audience on the page. And I do think it's worth looking at. And you may see it as dry, but, you know, hey, this is one of the top grossing films of last year, and it's critically acclaimed. To look at this script and say that it's bad, I think, is taking the wrong lessons from it.
And I, again, as I said, I found it very involving, the whole thing. There was only a couple of points where I was thrown out of the read. And interestingly, they were the same points where I was thrown out of the film as well.
Oh, so we should probably... So let's start with a quick summary. For those of you who haven't seen Gravity, essentially it is a, and I'm quoting from the script here, a space suspense in 3D, that there is some astronauts walking above planet Earth on the shuttle Explorer, I believe it is. Yep, the Explorer space shuttle. And one of these is Ryan Stone, a kind of first-time astronaut. She's had like 6 months training, and she's up to the air to install some kind of doohickey into some other doohickey. It's kind of irrelevant. And then basically they get a warning that there's debris orbiting the planet. And from there, things just escalate because ultimately it's a disaster movie. It's like they're on the Titanic and the ship's going down and she's got to try and find a way home. That sounds like I'm giving you a short summary, because that is pretty much the overall of the story. There is some specific beats that we'll talk about, but you don't really need to know much more than that. Ryan Stone needs to find a way to get back to Earth from space so she can survive.
Well, I guess we'll talk about this, but there's... an A plot, which is she has to survive and get back to Earth. And then there's the B plot, which is she has to want to survive and get back to Earth.
I'm not sure if I'd call that the B plot. I'd call that the motivation. But, you know, let's start with Snyder. Yeah, let's just jump in, right? And for this week, I think we should probably just focus on Snyder and Vogler. Michael Haig has talked about in last episode, has some overlap with Snyder, but his stuff is actually a lot more stripped down because, to be fair to him, a lot more of what he writes is about character development and its relationship to structure. It's prescriptive in ways that Snyder is about, you know, plot, but it's not worth going into here. So let's just focus on Snyder and Vogler for the time being.
Sure. Can we, do you mind if we, as we get to each plot point, we'll discuss both gurus rather than going through each guru at a time?
Well, okay. I'm going to put it out here at the beginning. I'm going to be controversial. I think both films are better examples of the hero's journey than they are of Snyder's Save the Cat.
Okay. Interesting. I would say that's true of Gravity, but I felt less so for Frozen.
Because I think Frozen
begin.
I think Frozen is very hero's journey. Okay, so with Gravity, kind of, you know, the classic Snyder thing is, what is your opening image? And as we talked about last week, what is the final image, the kind of mirror that sets up the story? The script quite deliberately opens on black and in silence, and then it has a card kind of setting the scene. But further down on page one, you have what is, you know, you could probably consider more of the opening image, which is, you know, outer space, 600 kilometers above planet Earth. And it's described as mythical and majestic. So we're above space in silence. The mirror image is her on land, back on Earth, standing up and being surrounded by sound. And that's something that they've done a very good job of in the film. It's not as written as much on the script, but the sound plays a particularly important role in creating that contrast. And, you know, and that is kind of the structure of the story, going from space where, you know, nothing can survive to Earth where everything can survive.
And so did you find in the opening sequence of the film there to be a save the cat moment or a statement of the theme of the film?
This is interesting. I mean, and we'll touch on it with both films. We're very lucky that the filmmakers have been very open about what they're intending the films to say. And so I'm going to go into this knowing that, you know, Cuarón has said this is a film about survival and wanting to survive and life. And so when I went looking for, you know, instead of trying to determine what the theme is, I was looking around page five, trying to see if there was anything that mentioned that specifically. And the closest I've got is this story where Matt Kowalski, who's the astronaut played by George Clooney, talks about how he went back to Earth and his wife basically ran off with another man, and he kind of had to pack up his bag and move on. And in some ways, that is the theme of the story, which is about you need to move on. You need to let go, or don't let go, as the trailer of the film, you know, was about. It is about that sense of moving on. So I think you could, I mean, this is definitely stretching it, but I could definitely see that those stories that Matt tell in some ways kind of meant to be paralleling the survival journey in space. They're meant to be that idea that our life is survival.
Absolutely. But one thing that I think we should say then is, so far we've analyzed three screenplays, and you should basically throw out Snyder's demand that a character state in dialogue pretty much on the nose what the theme of the film is. Do something like this where it is done in subtext, it's done cleverly, it's done engagingly.
Although...
Interestingly... Oh, yeah, go.
Although Frozen does state the theme in dialogue, it's just on page seven rather than on page five. And we're lucky that Jennifer Lee has said, you know, fear is the theme of Frozen. And the troll says, fear will be your enemy on page seven.
Yeah.
But it's also a children's film. You know, it needs a clarity of meaning that I think Gravity doesn't necessarily, it could be a little bit more subtle with that stuff.
Did you notice a line that on page 20, it might be 21 in the PDF of Gravity, where Kowalski says, as Ryan is spinning off structure, flying into outer space, struggling to detach herself, he says, you can't tune the world out up here. And it's such an on-the-nose line that it jumped out at me. And then I went and rewatched the trailer that has that whole section lifted, holus bolus, from the film, and they've cut the line because it rings out as so false. Like, you don't give someone a morality lesson as they're spinning off into space.
Yes, I've had friends that did not like the dialogue in this film, but I think they're trying to go for something that was very functional rather than clever.
Absolutely. But I'm just saying they cut that line. It is interesting,
yeah.
I thought. And on the nose, this is the theme of the film or the journey of the character, and we're cutting it.
Well, because I think the tagline was, you know, in some ways the theme. Don't let go, you know. It kind of has this dual meaning to me. You know, it's about letting go of the past. You know, it's like Up, got to let go of the house. You know, and talk about a visual theme. And also the idea of clinging on to survival, you know. You know, it is a very symbolic film, and I think Cuarón's very clever with the use of symbolism. And he calls out the symbolism in the screenplay.
So, should we jump to the catalyst?
What
do you think the catalyst is?
I think the catalyst is fairly clear, which is it's in a line of dialogue. And that's what's interesting is they did a catalyst in dialogue, you know, they told rather than showed. And the line is, mission control tells them, NORAD reports a satellite has incurred a missile strike. The impact has created a cloud of debris orbiting at 25 miles per hour. Current debris orbit does not overlap with your trajectory. We'll keep you posted on any developments. That is absolutely the catalyst. That is the shattering of the ordinary world in vulgar terms. And it is kind of, I mean, it's a call to adventure in a way.
Actually, can we talk about that for a second? Because called both Vogler and Haig, because Haig calls it an opportunity, it's interesting to me that they call the inciting incident or the catalyst an opportunity or a call to adventure. Because I think in certain stories, and Gravity is a prime example, it's really not a call to adventure at all, or it's not an opportunity at all.
Okay, I'm going to get a little bit more specific. In Vogler, not all the time, but the call to adventure is given by a herald, a character called the Herald. So it's not necessarily shown. So in here, the Herald is mission control. And I'm quoting from the writer's journey here. It just says, the hero is presented with a problem, challenge, or adventure to undertake. Once presented with the call to adventure, she can no longer remain in the comfort of the ordinary world. Right?
And yeah, I was, okay.
And then he gives example, obviously, the call to adventure from Princess Leia, you know, come fight the Empire. But what's interesting about Star Wars is it's given to Obi-Wan Kenobi, not Luke, even though Luke ultimately becomes the hero. And that ties into something that I think is important about this film, which is, I think, Matt Klawowski is the mentor character. He is the Obi-Wan
Absolutely.
Of the film.
Yes.
Right? And what's interesting, and yes, we're jumping to Vogler, he does drive the story for like the first half.
The midpoint of the film is her having to drive the story.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about that because it's like, oh, you know, the classic idea, the protagonist needs to be driving the story at every point. Ryan Stone doesn't. She makes a couple of bad decisions, you know, potentially her refusal of the call, which is like three lines of dialogue where he's like, you need to put a bow in it, Dr. Stone, Matt says to her, and she says, I can't. And he's like, I'm not going to ask you again. Not one second. You know, shut it down. And then she does it. It's like half a page refusal, right? To accept that how bad things are going to get.
The reason why I asked about the opportunity and the call to adventure is I think it's interesting because it does impact whether or not there's a refusal or not. I mean, you've highlighted there are a few lines of her not doing as she's ordered. And I think that was a really good interpretation that maybe she's refusing to acknowledge how dangerous this situation is. But beyond that, it feels like when you've got catalyst or an inciting incident that is a genuine opportunity that a protagonist lunges for, then there is often a refusal to the call, which is in related to the protagonist not wanting to leave the comfort of the known and leaping into the unknown. But where in this film, there's a shower of debris hurtling its way at you, there's only so long you can refuse it, if at all.
Yeah, she's forced to. That's why it's a call to adventure. But the reluctance, I think, which we've talked about, is important for character. And this is jumping to Frozen. I don't think there's any reluctance of the call, you know, refusal of call in Frozen. And we'll get into that more when we get there. But I think that's one of the few points where it deviates. But here, her reluctance, ultimately, you could see it's tied to the idea that she's reluctant to survive. She doesn't value her own life. I think that's what it's trying to say. Both, one, she doesn't understand the level of the danger, and two, she doesn't appreciate her own life. And I don't think that would have been, I think this moment, as small as it is important for setting up the later revelations of her character, you know, because I think what's interesting is here is this idea that she's someone who has to choose to survive, is that we get no hint that's who she is until there's this moment where she won't let go of her damn bloody, the doohickey going into the doo-wacky.
Should we be fair to Snyder and say that the Herald's announcement happens on page 12, whereas the actual mission abort call, i.e. when the characters realize that there's, the world, ordinary world, has been shattered, happens on page 15.
Yeah, and I think that whole thing, to be fair, again, fair to Snyder, does fall into the category of the debate. The debate, and I can't remember exactly what Snyder says about it, but there is this catalyst, a very clear thing, and we don't understand the full consequences of that until quite later. That there is this escalation, right, from page 11, where she asks, you know, where Matt says that the boys down there worry for us, to the mission abort, to the shut it down, ultimately to when she's floating away. I do think you can see that as this kind of debate sequence that's come as a responsibility for the catalyst, because not only is she kind of reluctant to let go and she doesn't value her own life, that the whole kind of her floating away kind of ends the first act because it's her decision to get a visual lock.
This is an interesting point because I actually wanted to talk to you about where the first act break is. But let's, for the sake of arguing Vogler versus Snyder here, Snyder says the debate should actually be a sequence between pages 12 to 25, which that's not the case here in Gravity.
I disagree. I think it is a sequence. It's a sequence that builds from the catalyst, the arrival of the debris, to the debris hitting and her floating away. That is all, to me, a sequence that's kind of even got broken into three. You got the beginning of the sequence, the catalyst, the middle of the sequence when it hits, and the end of the sequence is basically when she's getting a lock on the Explorer. I mean, you could probably argue that when it's when Matt comes over and tethers herself to him, but I think for me, the moment is her getting the visual lock because it's a character choice.
You honestly think she's debating for that whole time whether she wants to survive or not? Like, the minute the debris actually hits and Sharif is hit and she's trying to get back into the shuttle, she's freaking out and, yeah, trying her hardest to survive.
Yeah, but there's, you know, she's like freaking out, saying no, 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 give me anything. They flutter up, and then she swallows harshly, her throat goes dry, she can't breathe. We got that sequence that I talked about where it draws attention to her breathing. But then, and this is quoting for the script, her intellect engages and she gains a new sense of calm, you know, which is basically she glimpses something and then boom, she's able to take control. I see that as a choice. You might see that as a survival reflex. I think the way it's painted in the script is it's definitely a character moment, whether it's a choice or force.
I completely agree with you. It's just whether, to me, is her being flung into space and regaining control, is it a debate? Is it a refusal of the call? I agree with you that those three lines where she's not doing as she's being ordered, that's a refusal to the call. But as soon as her life is in danger, she wants to, you know, attend the call. She wants to live.
Yeah. And look, I mean, this is the very funny thing with Vogler is he basically says you can remix any part of the hero journey and you can remove steps if you want to. I wish I could find the page. Yeah.
Well, that's a useful get out of jail free card, isn't it?
Yeah.
the one thing I did want to say is I think it's interesting to think about the break into Act Two, because it could be when Matt rescues her, which is, it's interesting because this film gets away with two pieces of coincidence, I think, very well. The first piece of coincidence is, you know, they've got a shower of debris coming at them, right? And then the second coincidence is she's flung off into space. And I remember because I'd seen the trailers where she gets flung into space, and then I'm in the film and she's flung into space and it's like minute 17 or something. I'm like, holy crap. How on earth do they get her back? And then Matt just appears and rescues her.
Well, no, he's got their very super fancy device. I can't remember the name. There's a technical acronym.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying it's not credible that he does this. I'm just saying that it's not her. But to me, the act break was at where they find that Explorer has been completely destroyed on page 34. And I say this because really their goal when Matt's got her back, even from the beginning of the debris shower, the goal has been let's get into Explorer, right? Then she gets thrown off structure, Matt comes back and rescues her, they pick up the body of Sharif, and then they get to Explorer and they realize this is not their way home. There is a new goal, which is get to the International Space Station.
You know, and for me, and this is using a Vogler understanding of it, them tethered together is the beginning of the second act. That the meeting, because in Vogler, you have a meeting with a mentor, then you cross the threshold, right? So again, using Star Wars, classic example, Obi-Wan meets Luke, then Luke makes the decision to join Obi-Wan in his quest, and then Obi-Wan takes them to the whole journey to Alderaan. He's driving that half of it. For me, using that same metaphor in Gravity, the meeting with the mentor is Matt Klauowski taking over as a mentor. We saw him as like a joker. Then he gets very serious. He flies over, tethers himself to Ryan.
But he's already taken control as a mentor as the debris is hitting. Like, he's ordering her around. He's saying, can I go and rescue her? He's in her ear the whole time saying, you know, detach, I'm losing visual of you, detach. Like, he's, and
okay,
you
know, so
the
then
film is very good in its setup to say, this guy is so relaxed out here while she's freaking out. Even before the debris has happened, she's feeling nauseous. They're getting medical updates that she's not comfortable up there and he's super comfortable.
Okay.
Like, so that your mentor is well established.
You're kind of proving my point then. So you have the refusal of the call. He starts becoming the mentor. He reaches her, tethers her. And to me, him then bringing her back is the crossing of the threshold. I think that's because they make such a big visual of the tethering. And I also think thematically or more archetypally, the idea of the mentor being like a father figure or a mother figure, absolutely the tether becomes like an umbilical cord, you know, that they're kind of connected at that point. And her journey is tied to him. And so I think from a Vogel perspective, they are crossing the threshold as they head back to the shuttle. And what's interesting about Vogler, he kind of relates these steps to the axe. You know, as I mentioned before, there's kind of like a diagram about how they line up, but it's nowhere near as prescriptive about page count as Snyder is. So, you know, Snyder does say, yeah, the break into two is page 25, but, you know, Vogler is just like, there's a meeting with a mentor and they cross the threshold. So, yes, you could argue that it's when they hit the explorer and they realize they have to change their goal, or you could argue that it's them tethered together and as they make their way. It's a difference of pages, and I don't think it really helps us understand the story anymore. It's that movement, that kind of escalation of action and the way these characters together that is a useful thing to see how they've built this story.
Absolutely. And that to me raises a great point that you could argue that either of these two moments are a break from Act 1 to Act 2, and it doesn't matter a bit. What matters is that there's two discrete sequences with a goal. When she's flying off into space, the goal is, you know, someone come and help me, get in communication with Explorer, get back to Explorer is the goal. Matt comes, rescues her, they get back to Explorer, then there's a new goal. This screenplay is incredible at setting goals that the audience understands so clearly and so quickly.
Mm.
And they're all related to survival. And it's just incredible. And for me, you know, like you referenced that Shane Black analysis of Iron Man 3, who knows if Jonas and Alfonso Cuarón gave a crap where they'd break into Act 1 or Act 2 is. They just knew that because there was this clear, definable goal that these characters were rushing towards, that the audience would be there with them.
Yeah, and I think they do that visually, and I'd have to see the film again, but I reckon the first cut in the film is the beginning of the second act, and that is roughly when he rescues her, but it's definitely a continuous shot for, you know, most of the first, if not the whole first act. So it could be a very conscious decision.
It's for the first sequence, it cuts as she's flung off into space.
Does it? I thought it stayed with her.
It cut, like, because she, I don't know if you remember, but she, you know, gets flung off and she becomes a very tiny dot. And then it cuts to this inside the helmet spinning stuff and moves in between the amazingly. Yeah. I think one thing we should say is for a film that was, as you said, so animated and such an incredible technological advance and such an incredible cinematic experience, I thought there was going to be a ton of camera direction, but nowhere in the screenplay does it mention this. The camera has not cut yet by page 17, you know?
There's not very much at all through the helmet. There's a few references to that. So we get the sense of when they're shifting into kind of first person, they call it out.
I almost found it annoying when they would start cutting from inside the escape pod to outside the escape pod, because it was kind of necessary. I understood they're two different locations, but it was jarring to the read, where I think I could have coped without even having those slug lines interrupting it.
Hmm.
Anyway, so we're into Act 2, and they have a new goal, which is to get to the International Space Station. So Snyder says that in this kind of second sequence leading up to the midpoint, you need to introduce the B story. And the reason why I said character journey is a possible B story is it really her discussion of her daughter happens in there, and it's the first time that you kind of get to know who she is and what she's going to have to overcome to get back down to Earth.
Yeah, I think that's...
So whether you call it a B story or just the main, that there is only one story and it's both plot and character intertwined, it's fine. I'm just saying that this element of the story is only introduced on page 38.
Yeah, and look, when I watched it, my cynical brain was like, wow, this felt like a studio note, this inclusion of this backstory, because it feels like something that you could kind of just completely cut out of the film entirely. But it does explain her motivation, and having listened to Cuaron talk about it, I think it was a lot more integrated. I think they just needed to find the right moment to introduce that. So it is this nice moment where they're making their way to the ISS, and there's a quiet moment where they can kind of build this backstory and we can absorb it, because I think it is such an important way of understanding her character and what the film is trying to say. They needed this lull for you to be able to listen to it and understand it, which is probably why it stuck out like dog balls, but it's important.
But not only, like, to their credit, and we'll get to the later part of the movie where the part that really pissed me off, this bit didn't piss me off when I was watching the film or reading it. And to their credit, not only do they have a clear goal, let's get to ISS, they have two ticking clocks. They have her running out of oxygen and him running out of fuel in his jetpack thingy.
It's an MMU, a manned maneuvering unit.
Okay, thank you. I'm still going to call it a jetpack. And so even though it's this lull where they're introducing, you know, new elements and a deliberate lull, it's a pacing lull to let us recover from what we've just seen. And they're moving towards it. There is very much these guys' lives in danger. And Matt asking about her backstory is justified because he's trying to calm her down so she stops hyperventilating.
Mm. Oh, completely. And I think what is interesting, again, using Vogler, I do think this is part of the tests, allies and enemies section of the story. It's short in this film, a lot shorter than it is in Frozen, but it is them actually becoming allies. Using Star Wars, the test, allies, enemies example is the whole section when they get to Mos Eisley and they recruit Han and Chewbacca and all that stuff, right? It's when they start building the group that is going to win. And in a way, that's what they're trying to do here, that they're actually bonding and becoming allies. He's shifting from a mentor to become an ally. And there is small tests between them to do with the oxygen and them trying to get into the ISS.
With all due respect, I feel like you take out any sequence of any film that's ever been made and you could say that it would meet the definition of tests, allies and enemies.
Yeah, but there's a specific point. No, look, there's a specific point when they start recruiting allies that they are, that, you know, Frozen, this is jumping ahead with that analysis, but that's where you meet Kristoff
as a man
and Olaf. You actually meet them and they become part of the band, the party band that's going to conquer this. And I'm sure Indiana Jones...
Yeah, but much more so than in Gravity, where, you know, you're kind of having it both ways, because you're saying the tethering was, you know, and I think you had a very excellent analogy about, you know, the umbilical cord, because Cuaron has also been really open about his use of symbology of birth and that this is a resurrection and rebirth story, and he visually has a lot of birth imagery. So I think your tether umbilical cord example is bang on. But then, you know, he's there as a mentor, and yes, there's a subtle shift here from... But I think he still is the mentor. She's not really recruiting him. She needs him. She's such a passive character. Even in this sequence, she's freaking out and he's trying to calm her down.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look, I'm stretching that point, but because I actually think it's just the bit that stuck out most to me is the approach to the inmost cave. And we kind of brushed over it in the last episode because it wasn't as appropriate to Philomena and Dallas Buyers Club. But, you know, as I referenced, it's the idea of approaching the Death Star, you know, in the Millennium Falcon for the first time, when they realize that Alderaan is destroyed, right? In this case, the inmost cave, what I actually see is the inmost cave in the ordeal is what happens on the ISS, right? That the approach to it, this whole thing leading up to the beginning of the ordeal, is them coming into the ISS, them having to kind of land, her getting caught up in the parachute, and it ends with, well, not quite ends, but I think her letting go of Matt is part of it. And this... You know, I was kind of like, there's two ways you can analyze it. You can either say the ordeal begins with her letting go of Matt, but I actually think if you know, I'm going to stay true to the Vogler kind of imagery, the cave itself is the ISS. It's her having to go inside the cave, and she is literally losing Obi-Wan outside of the cave and having to let him go. And I think
So tell me the difference in Tell me the difference in Vogler terms between the inmost cave and the ordeal.
Right. So it's kind of is, as I said, it's the enemy base. It's about you're on the verge of going into the place where you're going to confront your ordeal, right?
Yeah.
And okay. The ordeal is kind of the middle of the second act. It is kind of what bridges the two. So you could see that the midpoint, her letting go of Matt is the midpoint in a way. And well, I mean, it absolutely is. I think, you know, it's the false peak. It happens on, I'm going to rephrase because there's some interesting comparisons here. So Snyder talks about, you know, all his page references are in reference to 110 page scripts. This is closer to 100 pages, right? But her letting go of Matt is page 45, right? And so that's a big moment. But then on page 55, you know, which is the classic Snyder midpoint, is when she actually tries to contact him again, right? Come on, Matt, talk to me, right? So it's kind of this, it's actually like a 10-page sequence. So she lets go of him and that's a huge dramatic moment and then she fights the way inside the module and then she reaches communication but then she realizes that he really, really is dead.
To me, there are these two sequences in Vogler or two, not necessarily sequences, but two beats or parts of the story, which is approach to the inmost cave and the ordeal. Mm. And where I think this film Gravity suits Vogler more than it suits Snyder is that there really are two really important beats very close to each other in the middle of the film. So her letting go of Matt, I think, is the genuine midpoint because she, well, arguably she doesn't start driving the story until she's lost communications with him because even when he detaches, he's telling her, you have to get to the Tiangong, the Chinese space station. You know, he's giving her all the instructions. You have to get inside. You're breathing CO2. You're feeling dizzy. You know, he's still, in a way, she's having to physically do it, but he's still, in a way, driving that sequence. But it's only when she gets inside. So there's two major beats. Matt detaching, so she's on her own for the first time and having to do things herself. And then the second one is her getting inside the International Space Station. And we were talking about Quaron's symbology before. It's described in the big print. For a moment, Ryan simply hangs in suspension, a fly in amber, surrendering to the poetry of the planets, rotating slowly in the cabin's womb. And in the previous sentence, she's been described as floating in the fetal position. So she's just detached from her umbilical cord and she's climbed into a womb of safety. So, but as you said, when she loses comms with Matt, she realizes she's genuinely on her own and starts driving the action.
And it is total hero's journey, taking over from the mentor, page 55. She says, oh, Matt, I'm not ready for this in dialogue, right? And then it says in big print, maybe a third of the page down, the way Matt would have done it, dash, you know, this is Mission Specialist Ryan Stone reporting from the ISS. And that moment, totally, you do get that on the screen that she's like, I'm not ready for this. But then she assumes the role of Matt and starts taking, you know, charge and speaks like him. And it actually says something about the dialogue that as much as you can say it was bland, her language changes from this point forward. That you actually sense the character change by the very way she talks. I think that's worth noting.
Be fair to Snyder, he also says there's a midpoint happening and it's happening around this point in the film. And what I like about Snyder's description of a midpoint, much better than Haig's The Point of No Return. Because for me, in most stories, the act one break is the point of no return. That's when the story has started to the point that the protagonist can't just go back to the beginning, rather than that happening at the middle of the second act or the middle of the film. I much prefer this idea of a false peak. And you know that I did some work with an English screenwriter called Andy Cox, who he describes the midpoint as the most success that the character has without changing. Like they keep on being the way they were at the beginning of the film. And this is the closest that they get to success before the reversal starts to force change on them. And here she's just been doing what she's been told fearfully right up until this point. And where you said, exactly as you said it, I'm not ready for this. Then she adopts Matt's way of being. She's had to change in order to succeed. And I like that. I think I think up until this halfway point of the film, we've got both Vogler and Snyder fitting very snugly.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, we're kind of dancing around trying to say, oh, it doesn't fit neatly into one way or another. The point is something super dramatic. A bunch of super dramatic stuff happens in the middle of this film. You know, you've got the character change. You've got the loss of the mentor. You've got a change in goal. This is a huge thing. For the moment, they thought the ISS was the way home, right? That should be able to get oxygen.
Yeah.
Then the second half kicks in. We've got fire, right? Page 55. Oh, and she even says, what now? Which is exactly what the audience thinks. It's like she's voicing there, holy shit. You know, we've had all this moment and then we've got something else. And it's kind of almost a repeat of all the survival stuff, but it's added with this sense that she is a little bit more determined. She hasn't completely changed, but she's becoming like mm-hmm. Matt. She's no longer helpless.
Yeah.
And
well, can I point out that they knew way back on page 41 that the ISS wasn't the way back to Earth. As they're approaching ISS, there's a line in dialogue from Matt Kowalski where he says, let me just get the line up. He says, second Soyuz exhibits surface damage and chute has deployed. Its use as an escape pod for re-entry to Earth is impossible.
Mm.
So they've said that on page 41. Then they have this great sequence where they're trying to get onto the ISS. Matt detaches, she climbs in and has her big, has a major character beat. But then the next sequence in Snyder terms is described as bad guys close in. And I'd just like to say, she tries to put out a fire on page 56. So there is a fire, the what now? Then she tries to get into the Soyuz by page 57. Then she has to try and get the Soyuz away from the space station that is on fire. Then it's caught in the parachute lines and she has to try and not crash the escape pod into the ISS on page 61. Then on page 62, she has to get back out into space and unbolt the parachute lines while the debris appears. I mean, those are four, you know, we're talking about from page 56 to 61, 62, 6 pages, there are four really defined goals. Each one, the reason there's a change in the goal, because there's been a massive escalation of the stakes.
Mm. And it's just a constant escalation. And, you know, if you see the bad guys, metaphorically or otherwise, is the debris, that's kind of like the return of the big bad, you know. It's the arrival of the Nazi lieutenant or whatever it is, you know. And I think that's, it's just this absolute escalation. But here's a question.
So does Vogler talk about what happens between ordeal and seizing the sword?
Well, because I think even though you can see the ordeal as part of the midpoint, I think in the context of this story, and it's not quite the midpoint, I actually think the ordeal, I think it does encompass, you know, the loss of Matt Ryan, going into to the module, dealing with the fire, because I actually think the ordeal for her, you know, it's meant to represent it's kind of like the first big character challenge. It's kind of like where we think that the characters are going to die, but they think they're going to die. You know, in Star Wars, it's them, potentially you could see it as them in the trash compactor. But for me, I think what is the darkest fear of Ryan in this story? I think it's when she's in the module and she's stuck, that she has no other options. I think that for me is her darkest fear. And I think that's probably where the ordeal is. And it is a sequence that kind of leads up into the seizing of the sword, which does dovetail nicely with Snyder, what Snyder was saying, which is, you know, you've got the all is lost moment, the dark night of the soul, and then the break into the third when the solution is found. The seizing of the sword and the reward is that moment. For me, I think in this story at least, there is an overlap, and again, this is analysis, not creation, but there is an overlap between the ordeal and the all is lost dark night of the soul. Because, I mean, here's the interesting thing. When do you think that the all is lost moment is?
Well, I totally agree with you. It's on page 68 where there is no fuel. She's managed to survive the second debris storm. She's detached the Soyuz. She's pointing the Soyuz. She's got it working, considering she's not very good at driving these things. She's got it lined up for Tiangong and she just wants to press a button and go.
Yeah.
And there's no fuel.
That's important. So let's. I'm just going to table this, but I'm going to point it out she had to, as part of this kind of like first challenge, the ordeal is her working out how to use this module, right? And she has to remember how to do it. So let's just table that for the moment. What is interesting here is I went, yeah, it's absolutely, that's what, when I read through, I marked it as page 68. And according to Snyder, it should actually be on page 75. And as we've made many points of, Snyder's page numbers are usually really whacked. But what is interesting, because I was just like, I'm going to humor him. I'm going to go to page 75. And it's not exactly 75, but the moment when she's, you've got
We have said we're 10 pages short.
Yeah. But when she's listening to the transmission with the baby and the boys, with I can't say it, any gang. The transmission grows fainter and fainter and fainter and then is gone. It's kind of, could also be seen as the all is lost moment, because that's when everything starts, you know, she surrenders. It actually says she surrenders on page 75. She weeps. You know, you could actually see this as the all is lost moment, because she's, not only has she lost fuel on page 68, she gets transmission, but then that's taken away and she's in absolute silence.
Yeah, I think there's two ways of looking at it, and I think it fits neatly, again, both into Snyder, both into Vogler. I think you can either say there is no fuel is the all is lost moment, and the dark night of the soul is that entire sequence of her talking to, is it Anangang, and deciding to die. She, you know, she turns off the oxygen and deciding to die. Now, interestingly, using your kind of alternative look at this, is you could say, well, her deciding to die, her, she's surrendering, is the all is lost, and the dark night of the soul is actually her hallucinating that Ryan's come back into the escape pod. Because I had originally thought exactly the first way, that all is lost is no fuel, and then this entire sequence is dark night of the soul, right? Or the ordeal in Vogler terms. But Matt appears and you feel this surge. I remember feeling it in the cinema. I was like, oh, that's such a cheap trick. I feel so ripped off, but I'm so happy that he's back. So I had this huge swell of emotion, and he arrives and he challenges her. He dramatizes the decision that she has to make. He turns all the oxygen off and says, it's really nice here, isn't it? Turning everything off and just going to sleep and never waking up. Yeah, and so to me, I was like, well, the dark night of the soul is still going, even though he's arrived.
Oh, yeah, he's absolutely the dark night of the soul. But yeah, it's a cheap trick. But man, it's so hero's journey. It's the ghost of Obi-Wan. Use the Force, Luke. You know, use the soft landing jets, Ryan. the soft landing jets. It's and, absolutely,
you
know, that moment.
You have to. He then says, like, he's got the two of the most on the nose lines. You have to start living life, Ryan. It's time to go home.
And then, Ryan, you have to learn to let go. Wait, but didn't he let go of her? And she couldn't do. Oh my God, so many meaning. No, that's me being unfair. But yes, absolutely. And it's funny. We got friend of the podcast, Krob. K-H-R-O-B from San Francisco, did send us a question. Yeah, crap. He did send us a question, which is, what act break does George Clooney's reappearance in the end of Gravity correspond to? And I think whatever way you want to cut it, it's the end of Act 2. It's the lowest point, is building up there, and he gives her the solution. He is like, I mean, he's like the lady in the lake handing over Excalibur, you know? Here, you know, go and take it back. And
she sees the sword, she's seized the want to live.
Absolutely. And she's given the knowledge, right? So, and it kicks off the road back. The road back in this thing is heading towards the Chinese station, gets it all going. She's on the road back. She's determined. So you've got the cool action sequence, and then it leads to her coming into the Chinese module. And this is what I was saying about noticing it, because one of the Vogler ideas is the first ordeal teaches you, doesn't always, can teach, give the characters what they need to know to survive their second big challenge, right? Which is, in this case, how to use the Chinese module. And I just thought that was an interesting parallel. You know, whether it was deliberate or not, it makes sense within the rules of this world. And then the road back is, you know, you've got the fiery return to Earth, and then she lands in water, and that's when we've got resurrection, you know? She is sucked down, you know, and resurrection is the last big challenge, right? You know, when there's one last trick up the sleeve, you've lulled the audience into a false sense of security and there's something else. You know, in Aliens, it's the arrival of the queen alien on the ship. In here, it's her landing in the water, but then sinking. Oh my God, you know, she's fighting so hard in zero gravity to get back to Earth. And now gravity is the very thing that could potentially kill her, you know. And yep. then she manages to get out of there, opens up, escapes, and then pops up through water. And, you know, water is such a symbol of fertility and rebirth and baptism and all that stuff. It is an absolute resurrection moment, you know. And the return yeah. with the elixir is her getting on land.
Oh, sorry, yeah, you know? Keep going.
Determined, and it even says, I mean, it says she's punched drunk at the end, which is, I think, the ending image, you know, the low-angle, wide-angle shot. She begins to walk on planet Earth laughing. She has found her will to live, you know, and I think that is the elixir.
Where I will agree with you is I think, first of all, this film fits... I think it fits Snyder and Vogler pretty accurately. I think our discussions have shown that it passes through all these beats almost as they say they should. Mm. So it's a very archetypal story. Where I think Vogler is a better fit for this story is just because he is so... We said this last week with Philomena and Dallas Buyers Club. We were noticing it in terms of how it didn't fit those films, but... that he is so much more detailed about what happens from the end of Act 2 through to the end of Act 3, whereas Snyder is limited to, I mean, so...
Finale.
All is Lost, Dark Night of the Soul, break into three, finale.
In Snyder, the finale is 25 pages, and that's your advice, finale. It's like progress.
And not only that, this...
Finish it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a long Act 3. It's a long sequence.
And what's interesting, and it's worth pointing out with Vogler, is he is giving his interpretation of Joseph Campbell's The Hero with 1,000 Faces. His is not the only one out there, right? And I'll put some links into the show notes of some of the other interpretations. And what is interesting is The Hero with 1,000 Faces has even more beats for the third act. So there's the refusal of the return is an idea you can use, that the character decides they want to stay in the extraordinary world and don't want to return home. And then they've got a crossing of the threshold back. So yeah, I mean, The Hero's Journey definitely, because it's so much more about, I guess, you know, in that archetypal sense, it's returning with the elixir to your community, bringing something back to your community that I think it actually has a lot more to say about the third act.
The other reason why I think this fits, and Snyder alludes to it by saying that the break into the Act 3 is the discovering of the solution, which could be interpreted as being similar to seizing the sword in Vogler. But I like Vogler's term of a reward, and I don't think all films fit this. We found that, for example, last week, we found that Philomena did fit it. She was rewarded before she went into the final sequence, but Dallas Buyers Club, we didn't feel that the reward happened on the second to last page of the entire film. And so a lot of films choose to reward their protagonist after the climax, whereas other films choose to reward their protagonist as the break into Act 3, that they need their reward to survive the final sequences of the film.
And I think the reward is handled in a more classic Vogler way in Frozen. So I'm just going to use this to very inelegantly change the topic to Frozen. And I'm going to start with the leading question, which is, who do you think was the protagonist?
Ah, damn it, you got in first. I have that question written down to ask you. I do very much think that Anna is the protagonist of the film, but I don't think that Elsa is the antagonist.
Interesting interpretation. I was going to argue that Elsa is the one that has the biggest character journey, and Anna she's the hero, but she changes the least. They give her a very subtle change, which is the idea of her, you know, learning about what real love is, but only romantic love, and that's the B story. You know, that's the change, because otherwise she is described in the script as fearless. And one of the few ways it breaks with Vogler is that she isn't even reluctant in terms of rescuing her sister.
So can I say that the way that I've always used the definition of who a protagonist is the person whose decisions drive the story. And it usually is the person who undergoes the largest change. But I think you and I are talking about doing an entire podcast dedicated to films where the protagonist doesn't have the largest arc, where there's a main character who's separate from the protagonist. And I think this is perhaps one of those examples.
Look, I don't think it's a big deal because for me, the film really did work. And I think often stories can have a change, but it's not necessarily the main character who changes. You know, the example, and we'll deal with it more in that episode, is Die Hard. It's not John McClane that changes. It's his wife, you know, but there is still a change relative to that character. And I think this is a good example because I think Frozen is even more than Gravity, evoke the hero's journey. And I think it fits the hero's journey much better than it does fit Snyder. You know,
By the way, let me just put my cards on the table. I'm not a fan of Snyder or Save the Cat. I just felt that this film diverted more from those archetypal story beats than Gravity.
That's interesting because I thought, as I said, I think it adheres to the hero's journey more. And I mean, maybe I was looking for it because the thesis coming in was, would these bigger tentpole films more closely adhere to the guru formulas because they are meant to reach to a wider audience? And as we said, they're not biopics, so they have the potential for that more constructed third act. But it's the third act that I think this departs the most with from Snyder. But, you know, should we start from the beginning? Did you want to summarize Frozen for us, Chaz?
Okay, Frozen is a retelling of the classic story of the Snow Queen, but it's only very loosely connected to that old tale. It's about two sisters, one of whom has special powers to be able to manipulate ice, and the sisters are princesses of a kingdom. And when the Snow Queen, when Elsa, the sister with the magic powers, is made queen, the stress of it makes her freak out and she freezes the entire kingdom accidentally. And then it's about following Anna to try and get her sister to unfreeze the kingdom.
Okay.
So you said it yourself that there's such a super clear statement of the theme in the film that fear will be your enemy, where the troll, Grandpappy Troll, says it to Elsa.
It helps that we have a podcast, which we'll also link to, where Jennifer Lee actually says that's the theme. Because out of interest, I went to page 5 and was like, wonder if I could see a Snyder theme, statement of theme. And in a way there is, and again, this is stretching, but it shows you that how the theme is manifested dramatically, which is the king. So the opening kind of epilogue is Elsa accidentally freezing her sister, right? And the king and the queen walk in and the king says, Elsa, what have you done? This is getting out of hand. And the queen is like, Anna, you know, she's ice cold. So in a way, that scene is about the parents' fear. You know, it's not a statement of the theme in terms of verbally, but absolutely is a dramatization of the theme. And that's the whole setup.
Yeah, it is what plays out there is a miniature play out of the entire plot of the film. So let's look at the differences. And I think I agree with you here, which is, do you think that's the catalyst to the story? Is Elsa freezing Anna?
You could, but I think a clearer catalyst is the coronation day. There's two reasons for this. One, it does actually fall on page 12. And two, it's a time jump and the world is changing. So what happens previous to this page 12 is after Elsa nearly killed her sister, she has to hide away, not use her powers, and the parents shut the doors, and then the parents die. But then this ultimately leads to the coronation day where they have to let people in. Elsa has to come out in the open, right? So for me, it's a catalyst because it's a, you know, it's kind of like the coincidence that forces the chain of events to happen, you know?
You said that you didn't feel there was a debate. I feel that there was, if you're looking at Elsa's character, and it could be interesting to argue that this film is actually two protagonists because the reason why we're even having this discussion is Elsa is such a well-drawn character and that she has entire sequences and scenes and moments all to herself. And as you said, she arguably has a bigger character change than Anna, but she does debate, you know, she refuses her powers. She's doing what her parents told her to, which is to try and hold them, try and control them. She's got, you know, a song about it. Whereas and we can talk about whether you think the first break into act two is, but then when she freezes the kingdom, she sings a song about letting all that go and just embracing being her. So it's kind of throwing off of the debate.
Yeah, that ties to who's the caller to venture to, you know, if you're using the Vogler thing. I mean, obviously, on the one hand, the call to the adventure is, you could see it as Elsa running off, and that's the call to venture to Anna. She doesn't refuse it. She's just like, I've got to go get my sister back. She's not going to hurt me. Whereas Elsa is a little bit more conflicted. She accidentally freezes things, and then that ultimately leads to those consequences. So I do think this is something that's different. And it should also point out, because I actually think this is quite a long first act, because I think pretty clearly
hugely long.
The first act ends as soon as Anya sets off after Elsa, because that is the leaving of the ordinary world. You know, it's crossing the threshold, and it's like the call of, I'm going to, you know, the goal is clearly established. I'm going to save my sister, and she's going to end this winter, right? But that happens on page 36. So it's quite a long first act. It's absolutely awesome. I love this movie, and it helped, you know, it's got the musical numbers that do so much of that. But I also think it's because it is establishing two characters. So it's building up Anna, right? And you've got the song about love being an open door, which is important in terms of setting up Hans and the big, what will become the B story, which is, you know, Anya's understanding of romantic love. But it's also sets up the villains, and, you know, there's all this setup that they're doing that is part of the reason I think it leads to a first act, plus dealing with Elsa's, you know, power and trying to make us sympathetic to her. You know, you've got the confrontation. Yep. What did I ever do to you? Why do you shut the world out? What are you so afraid of? All that stuff all happens on page 30, and it's got to lead into that climax. So, yeah, that's probably the debate, in that it is a long sequence, the opening of the doors to the kingdom leading to Elsa running away and then Anna following after her.
So I would completely agree with you that it's a long act, but you just to play devil's advocate here, you could argue that the act break isn't at page 36, it's at page 32 where Elsa reveals her powers and runs across the ford on page 33 because she's leaving into a new world where she's running up the mountain and she freezes the kingdom.
Mm. But yeah, I mean, it shows you how complicated that this is. Just the subtle way that they've changed the role of the villain kind of challenges these conceptions of structure. But
there really isn't a villain until, for me, the third act of the entire film.
Yeah, because they have to introduce one. And that's what's very clever. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a planted in there to kind of take over. What did you think is the B story?
Well, I like your interpretation that the B story is Anna learning about the truth about love, learning. Well, I've got to steal from Jennifer Lee here. She says Elsa needs to learn how to not be fearful, and Anna is like the opposite of that. She's the embodiment of love, and she loves too much, too easily, too quickly. So, yeah, she learns, I guess, how to love sensibly, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that the B story is the romance for that reason. I mean, it is, you know, as we've talked about before, it is the classic B story. Is the romance and the love story, and it builds into what we think, you know, sometimes the A story and the B story combine in the third act. You know, it's the classic when two cases become one case, you know, to quote, kiss kiss bang bang. And it's usually the same with the love story, and this film obviously subverts it quite cleverly. What is also interesting is I think this, you know, you've been asking for what a good example of tests, allies and enemies is as a sequence, and I think this film is what provides it, because it is Anna recruiting. She meets Kristoff, she meets Sven, she meets Olaf, and, you know, there are different tests. There's them beating the wolves, there's them climbing the mountains, there's them ultimately walking over the glass bridge to come into what will become the inmost cave, which is Elsa's palace. And I think that stuff is super clear.
And to be fair to Snyder, all of that stuff would have been in the trailer for the film. So, you know, fun and games, promise of the premise, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Olaf is a huge part. But okay, so yeah, I think this is my note. Promise of the premise is Olaf, I guess. That's what I wrote.
Yeah. But the Let It Go and the creation of the ice castle.
Mm. Yeah, yes. And that's interesting that we get that whole sequence in there. And I guess that's the enemies moment of Vogler. That's where we get spend more time with the enemies. And we're going, oh my God, you know, she's letting go. She's becoming a villain. And then this leads us into the midpoint. which is the confrontation with Elsa, right? And that, you know, it's a good example of a midpoint as well, because it's what we thought was the goal of stop Elsa become something else, which is, you know, save Anya. It's that, it is that classic shift. It's a false, it's both the false peak, the raising of the stakes, because now Anya's life is at stake. And she also didn't think her sister could hurt her, and she's wrong. She did, it accidentally or otherwise. So I think that is a really good example of the midpoint. And it is a good example of the ordeal that Anya's biggest fear was that her sister, even though she actually says, my sister would never hurt me, and her sister has. So it is kind of her confronting that fear, right?
And it's also her being, you know, to refer back to that Andy Cox kind of point of view, it's as successful as she gets. Because, you know, she arrives in the castle and Elsa's happy to see her. Mm. And they, you know, they have a talk. And that's exactly the way Anna planned it. I'm going to talk to her and she's going to unfreeze the kingdom and everyone's going to live happily ever after. And for that's as successful as she gets, adhering to her plan, and then it, you know, it falls out from underneath her.
No, I was just going to ask when it actually happens, because I actually it's actually kind of a late midpoint. I'm just flicking through the script.
Page 70.
There you go.
But that's because all of these points are kind of subtly off, because I think the first act is, and Jennifer's said this in all the podcasts, it's a large third act. It's 5 to 10 pages longer than normal because of the sheer quantity of storytelling that they get in there.
And I'm sure being a musical and transcribing the lyrics is going to shift all the rhythms of the on-the-page timing, because it definitely felt like a midpoint to me when I saw it. Yeah, this feels
it's interesting that you say the Anna being hit in the heart, the ticking clock of that doesn't start for me until that's the driver of the break from Act 2 to Act 3, because even though Anna is struck in the heart and her heart is freezing, they don't find out what that means for the characters for quite a few pages.
Yeah. I mean, so
page 87, she's told that she will freeze unless thawed by an act of true love.
That's what makes this midpoint so cool. One, there's dramatic irony. Yeah, you have the character change, you have a change of the goal, plus they're planting the bomb under the table for the audience of, oh my God, her heart's frozen. And we know that what that means, and Kristoff knows what that means when he discovers it. And he's like, I've got to take you to meet some people. They'll know what to do, right? So that, I guess, leads in to my question about bad guys close in. And specifically how that then builds into the all is lost moment. Bad guys closing, I guess, is fairly clear. It's the Duke sending his men to go and capture Elsa. And that in a weird way is also setting up Hans. In hindsight, you can see that he's part of that sequence. Because there was that moment when he comes in and like, oh God, he's put Elsa in chains. I'm not sure I like this guy anymore, you know? And it is the bad guys closing in, but they're the bad guys closing in on Elsa. I thought that was what was interesting. As Elsa, I mean, you've got Elsa with the marshmallow.
The giant snowman chasing them off the cliff. I think that's, you know, a bad guys close in sequence.
Yeah, but he's not quite as villainous, because I think they describe him as like he's meant to be like a bouncer. Yeah, he tosses them down the steps and he says, you've got to leave. There's some little bits and
they
pieces.
They jump off a 200-foot cliff.
Right.
I think it's fair for a kid's film, that's pretty menacing.
Yeah, okay. And that, I think, the jumping off the cliff happens on page 74. It happens on what Snyder says should be the all is lost moment. So where do you think the all is lost moment is?
I had it as Elsa is... Like, there's two. This is could almost be argued to be a dual protagonist film. It's on page 87, Anna is told that her heart will freeze unless thawed by an act of true love. And on page 90, Elsa is knocked out by the chandelier. So, for me, those could arguably be breaks into Act 3. But the true all, if you... These beats, I think, are reversed. I think the all is lost moment and the dark night of the soul happen within Act 3 of this film. And the all is lost is there's within 3 pages, Hans reveals he's a psychopath and Anna is dying in her room and is marching down to Elsa in the dungeon to kill her.
Yeah, look, I think that's what makes this film more suitable to Vogler. Because I think your analysis is correct. Because you look at it and you go, wow, it is quite late. But it feels more like the beginning of the third act than the end of the second. if you look at the Vogler with the idea of the ordeal kind of does cover everything from the confrontation with Elsa right until pretty much the trolls and her realizing, but it doesn't feel that dark. But, you know, there is the seizing of the sword and the reward. And you know, this is kind of perhaps stretching the analysis, but the reward is that she actually gets a solution to her problem, which is not the problem of Elsa, but her problem, which is that true love can unfreeze a broken heart. And that is kind of the reward. And then the road back is in the journey leading to Arendelle to be with Hans, right?
And I feel like you're stretching. I mean, it's certainly, to me, that fits more into the break into three, because the solution to the protagonist problem is found. That's more of a fit for Snyder's break than Vogel's. But I do have a question for you. You know, Snyder's got this sequence called Bad Guys Close In that's between the midpoint and the All Is Lost and Dark Night of the Soul. And we're kind of seeing that fitting here. And when you're discussing Vogler, you're discussing kind of the midpoint as the ordeal, as well as the aftermath of the midpoint resulting in the escalation of the stakes. Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, look, that's how I interpret it, because I think the ordeal, while it encompasses the midpoint, right, it also leads to the reward. And I do kind of see them as kind of the two sequences in the second half of the second act. The ordeal is one sequence that is both the beginning of the midpoint leading to dealing with the consequences with that, and then the reward as well. Now, to be fair to Vogler, while he does show some overlap with the act breaks, he doesn't explicitly talk about act breaks as much as others. So yeah, the road back is them heading, they're getting to deal with the consequences of kind of like the dark forces that have been unleashed, right? So it is them, you know, it's a chase sequence and stuff like that can happen in the road back, right? And there is a very physical...
But is that in Act 2 or in Act 3? I think a lot of films have a very clear either one or two sequences between a midpoint reversal and the kind of sequence where all is lost and the character is put through, you know, call it Dark Night of the Soul, call it whatever you want. Is that sequence somewhere in the Vogler? Is there an equivalent to that?
Not the all is lost moment. That's what I'm saying. I think it's kind of accompanied with the ordeal and the reward.
Because that means the ordeal is basically almost a 30-page thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is me making it stretch the analysis, because I do think there's some films where that reward that ends the, in terms of Vogler's diagram, the reward does end the second act, right? Got the information on how to conquer it.
I mean, you're right to an extent in that they learn what it is that they need to save Anna, right? And conveniently, it's also what's needed to save Elsa and to save the kingdom. And arguably, Vogler has, because for me, the reward here and the seizing of the sword happens like at the end of the film when, you know, that... Sorry, I'm just saying that these beats where they are rewarded for everything happens after the climax. Unlike Gravity, unlike Philomena, these guys get what they deserve after the climax of the film. Whereas in this film, in Frozen, they're given the information that they need to kick off the Act 3, but that's it.
But you see, I think for me, this covers as resurrection. I absolutely think the third act is about the resurrection of Anna. She dies, you know. That's the it's drawn out, but her death, right, ultimately leads to her resurrection. And the return with the elixir is that Elsa is given the elixir by Anna, in that she understands that her sister truly does love her. And by understanding that love, she is able to free the kingdom of snow, you know, of the winter. Yeah. And then she gains control of her powers because her fear is replaced by love. And that is the elixir that Anna gives to her, gives to the community, right? And I just think that the resurrection, there is obviously a very specific moment of resurrection when she's, you know, hands the sword is coming down and she turns to stone. She is dead and she saves her sister with an act of true love. But I think that whole road back and resurrection does compass the third act. It's just that there's... What makes it difficult with the Snyder is the Snyder has shifted the dark night, the dark moments of the soul. You know, it's the end of the second act. In this story, it's so not. It's the beginning of the third act.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree with that. But I feel that Vogler's got kind of two bites of the cherry that, as you said, he himself says you can skip steps, right? And still adhere to his analysis of story. But I feel that in terms of all stories generally, he's got two bites of the cherry because he offers a reward at the end of Act 2 and then a return with the elixir at the end of Act 3.
But, you know, I'm just going to, because it's still the hero's journey example. In Star Wars, he's rescued Princess Leia. That's the reward. They leave the Death Star with Princess Leia, which is kind of what they set out to do. But that is not the great moment of triumph is then when he destroys the Death Star, right? But that's not what he set out to do. He set out to rescue the princess. So absolutely, that's, you know, got the two bites of the cherry.
Yeah, I'm not saying that there aren't films that don't fit this to a T. I'm saying I don't feel that Frozen does. I don't feel that there is a reward at the end of Act 2 that's driving this. I think it's more of a punishment, if anything. It's the start of the ticking clock that she's going to freeze. It's the knowledge of how to fix it, but they misinterpret the knowledge.
Yeah,
they think...
I don't understand why you're rejecting the idea that their knowledge of how to defeat the... It's the stolen plans of the Death Star, you know? There is a reward. They know how to defeat it. They still have to do it, but they know what they have to do. You know?
Yeah. I think I'm getting hung up on the term reward, because I think seizing the sword, yes, she's got a sword. She knows that true love is the answer, although the act of true love, she doesn't know what it is and just does it instinctively. So in the same way, she's always had the key as well, because she's always had that instinctive over-loving nature. And, you know, it's just such a well-set-up end where Kristoff is trying to find her to kiss her. Hans is trying to find Elsa to kill her. And I had no idea how that was going to play out. Well, I did. I thought it was going to play out in the traditional Disney way, that Kristoff was going to kiss Anna and Anna was going to be fine. And then Anna was going to denounce Hans or whatever and save her sister. And then her sister was going to unfreeze the kingdom. And they were so clever by subverting all those expectations of traditional Disney films.
Yeah, I completely agree. And look, I, as much as we're arguing over the details of Vogler, and by no means should it be a formula for creation, but what is interesting is that idea of the road back and resurrection, and as I said, there's even more detail in the other hero's journey stuff, so much more useful in helping coming up with these ideas than finale. Because what is
absolutely
finale, it's not going to guide you into what they come up with. This idea, like that moment when you're like, she's sacrificing herself and you're balling up, that's, you know, huge. And it comes from the idea of resurrection. It is a very, and look, resurrection myths are in lots of different, resurrection stories. And, you know, and they are tapping into that, and they found a beautiful way of doing it that was, surprising but inevitable.
I guess what I'm, and we've said it already, this podcast as well as in the last one, I think Vogler provides so much more guidance for Act 3. I think he provides, I don't think any of Haig or Snyder or Vogler give very good guidance on how to get through Act 2 at all. And I think these two scripts, well, all four scripts that we've looked at in these two episodes have had amazing drivers to get through their story. And they're so clever with how they do it. And the only reason they meet any of these kind of guru formulas is because those guru formulas are so kind of empty in the second act. But to be fair, in this film, I think the second act fits Snyder slightly closer than Vogler because, you know, like I think that's what I was pushing you on before, is that your understanding of the ordeal spans almost 30 pages of this script.
Yeah, look, I think this script, the balance is interesting because you could argue under Snyder, if you do want to completely cling on to the dark night of the soul and all is lost when Anna is dying and Hans rejects her, kind of happens on page 106, in which case it's a pretty short third act. It's like ultimately like five or six pages.
I'm just saying that all is lost and the dark night of the soul is still there. They just, the break into Act 3 happens beforehand. So... yeah, look, I think one thing that we can definitely say is that both Gravity and Frozen, as the two largest box office original stories that aren't, you know, we deliberately excluded things like Iron Man 3 because we couldn't attribute their box office to just what was in the story. That's why we search for original properties. So these are the two highest grossing original properties, and they by far cleave to these story archetypes much more closely than the character-driven dramas that were populating the Academy Award nominations.
Although, as we've said time and again, it means they're good tools for analysis, not necessarily good tools for creation, though they help you ask good questions, you know. Dark Night of the Soul, I think, is a great question to ask of yourself and your characters. You know, what is the all is lost moment for your character? What is the dark night of their soul? I think, you know, there's stuff that I use. And I've you know, worked on features where we actually talk about that. Like, this is not stuff that is just stays in books. People don't necessarily adhere to the formula, but they do define the way that we talk about screenwriting and the questions that we ask in screenwriting.
I was actually struggling to think of a film that doesn't have a dark night of the soul. And the only examples I could come up with are the Roger Moore James Bonds, specifically the Roger Moore James Bonds, because at no point in any of those films, even when Roger Moore was in Moonraker, he's in a pool and he's, you know, getting strangled by a python, you are under never any doubt that he's going to prevail.
I mean, the Bond movies, their own kind of thing, you know.
They defy analysis. But no, I just think it's hard to find, you know, these archetypes exist for a reason. I think it's hard to find a film where a character is not pushed to the point where everything is lost and that they are confronting themselves as a result of having lost everything.
For me, thinking about it rather than about it being formulas, it's about rhythm, you know, peaks and troughs. Or again, to come back to Shane Black, you know, he says it's about set off, payoff and reversals. And the thing is, the dark night of the soul, you know, it's like music. It's like the quiet bit. So you can build up at the end of the song and build to the climax. But the climax won't seem so big if the points before it aren't soft, if you want to have that kind of peak and trough structure. And there are films that I don't think do follow this. I mean, you know, I'd have to undergo Irreversible again, but I would suspect that doesn't have a dark night of the soul because it's not that kind of film.
So what have you learnt from conducting this exercise on Frozen and Gravity?
Look, I think what's interesting is the way that they kind of weave between using those archetypal structures that are trying to tell more archetypal stories. I think particularly Gravity did set themselves out with the goal of trying to tell something that was both symbolic. So the idea that they were using stuff that was more mythological in terms of structure, whether consciously or not, is not surprising. But I like the fact that they seem to borrow what was useful for those stories. But never at one point did I feel like they were forcing the structures onto the stories that they were making.
Can I venture? I think the biggest thing that I've learned from, and this is not just from these two films, it's from all four films, is that I think all these story beats are here, but I think what is actually an unhelpful idea and concept is that there is three acts.
Really?
Yeah, I find, yes, there is a beginning and there is a middle and an end, and all of these four films adhere very strongly to a first act, and they break into from a first act into a second act. But I find all these four films, it's not actually been a useful exercise to ask when do they break from a second act into a third act. And yes, sure, there's a road back, so they leave the extraordinary world, and there might be a slight use in saying, all right, now there's going to be a change in location. And that's useful, but for me, it's much more useful to think of it in terms of, all right, there's an all is lost, there's a dark night of the soul, and then there's a seizing the sword and a reward, and we just plunge towards the climax of the film from there. I find the idea of arbitrarily deciding that there's a second act and a third act not helpful, and I think that a lot of these films might have arguably four or five acts, you know, back in Shakespeare's view, because of the reversals and the positioning of the sequences that they have.
Not next episode, but at a point it'd be good to look at sequence structure, maybe even very quickly look back on our favorite scripts from these four to see if they actually more closely use sequences, because my gut feeling is that they do a lot more clearly broken down in sequences, and that those kinds of movements are more useful than this kind of strict balancing of the third act. Because I think following on from that is this idea that the first act's 25%, the third act's 25%, and the second act is 50%. Because as you can see, this stuff doesn't closely align on the page, suspect that it'd be interesting to look at the final films, but that's also because as much as the 1 minute